to the Cork Chamber podcast. Thank you for coming along today.
Firstly, Fiona, thanks very much to you and this fantastic opportunity to sit down and talk with you today and outline what the NMCIA delivers for, I suppose, for Ireland as the intent of it, but more importantly for Cork. I suppose my interest in the sea was kind of sparked when I would have been sailing in Cork Harbour, and that's kind of where it started and kind of would have been fascinated. There's obviously a lot of shipbuilding was in Cove back in the day. You'd had a lot of kind of vessels coming in and out, so the presence of the maritime was very much on your doorstep, so to speak. I was very lucky. I had an opportunity to go on the STA tall ship, the Winston Churchill. I must have been about 17 or 18. So I did about 3 weeks on that, and on part of that voyage, got to stop off in Dartmouth, the Royal Naval College, where they trained their officers, and that kind of planted a seed that was kind of there already and kind of helped it kind of foster and develop. Then I applied for a cadetship in the Irish Navy. I didn't get it the first time, got it the second time. And then I think was it September 2000, we started our training as a cadet in the Irish Navy.
Maybe the seed was there already, but what kind of made you want to go further and progress in that career? It must have been something that you really loved in your early 20s.
Yeah, I think with a military career, it's kind of is it vocational in kind of nature, same as a career at sea, actually, kind of a maritime career. I liked the appeal of the challenge. It wasn't kind of 9 to 5. There was opportunity with it. There was challenge. Having played a lot of team sports, you were kind of part of the, it was that appeal that you got to develop on your own, but you were part of a greater good, if that made sense. So it was that kind of a myriad of attractions really to that role.
Were there times over your career, particularly in the early days, that you were thinking, I don't know if this is for me, I've made the wrong call? It isn't an easy job. Like there's sacrifice with this job.
Yeah, there is. Like you do spend time away a fair bit, but I suppose when you're younger it doesn't really matter. Like obviously as we got older and kind of settled down, got married, had children, there's that kind of you're more away from home. Actually one part to that, I remember, like when I was younger, you'd go in, there might just be an incident happens where you might end up back in Hull Boland for a night, and I used to never understand why people who were married with kids never went home, or had kids, not necessarily had to be married, but it was just the routine gets destroyed. Like you going home is great, you get to see the kids, but you have to go back the next morning, whereas the kids now think you're home. So then obviously your partner is left to tidy up that mess. It's something that struck with me because it obviously informed my own thinking as my career progressed and had a family of my own. Did I ever kind of doubt my decision? Not really. At one stage as a cadet, I thought, should I have been a marine engineer as opposed to a ship driver? Because my dad's a mechanic, kind of fitter background. But kind of got not talked out of it, but just realized kind of that the passion was for the ship driving and the navigation, so kind of the warfare side. I suppose when you're on the West Coast at 2 a.m. and force 8 or 9 getting hammered, you do kind of wonder sometimes, what am I doing here? But again, like as I probably touched on earlier, the camaraderie, the teamwork, you do kind of get to know people. And I suppose moments like that show what the ship and the crew are capable of, because sometimes the bigger demands are made of you when the odds are kind of against you a little bit. It's easy when the it's a sunny day off the West Coast and you're eating an ice cream up and watch and everything's good in the world. But sometimes for some of the more kind of interesting operations would have been part of throughout my career, it's always kind of at night, the weather not so favourable, and you do kind of wonder, what am I doing here? No different to anyone else. But it's like any other job. You always have days where you're kind of wondering, where are you? But at the end of the day, you're kind of happy with your decision and you move on.
You've had some amazing highs in that career, though.
Yeah, I was quite lucky. So my career for probably much of the first 15 years would have been quite similar to everyone else's, in that I went through a 2-year cadetship, got commissioned as an ensign in the Navy, did 3 years in CIT, and actually my last year would have been the first year in the NMCI. So the NMCI opened in 2004. After that, then it was a mixture of what we call seagoing rotations and staff appointments ashore. I got to train a cadet class, which was good fun. So after that, you were back to sea again. During that time, you would have gone through a series of promotions. And I suppose from 2017, my career would have taken a slight divergence from what would have been the norm. I was very lucky. I got selected to go to the UK Defence Academy to do their advanced command and staff course. which would have been a first in the Navy. So that was an interesting year. And then I came back and would have been the first Navy person to lecture in the Command and Staff School in the Curragh, the Defence Forces Training Centre. And that coincided with the development of a joint course where you were trying to bring the services together and try and establish that culture where the Defence Forces is a, you know, it's three services, it's the Army, the Air Corps and the Naval Service, and just bringing that together. So I suppose my career would have been slightly different then to what others. And then when the Commission on the Defence Forces was announced by government, I was extremely lucky and had the privilege of being the only military officer assigned to that for, I'd say, just over a year. So we got terms of reference from government and then had to see that through with a commission. And hopefully that'll inform the future of the Defence Forces, how it's shaped, how it gets designed. After that, went to sea and got to be captain of P-63 LE William Butler Yeats.
That must have been a huge moment of pride for yourself and for your family to see you in that uniform with that degree of responsibility. What kind of sacrifices did you make to have to maintain that position?
Look, like everyone else on the ship, you're all going away from family, friends. So yeah, there is that element of sacrifice, but there's a lot of other people making that as well. And I suppose it all depends on the outlook that you take. If you look at it constantly like it's sacrifice, I think it becomes more complex and more difficult. I think you just need to look at it that you're going to work and you just move on with it. We're very fortunate, like sometimes depending on the ports you get to go to, your family can visit for a day or something. So you'd always try and encourage the crew to avail of that time with family if at all possible. And then there's obviously times when the ship is back in Hull Boland and you're kind of based between home and the ship. I know while it might seem there's a sacrifice or an element where you're away all the time, it is manageable. And I think, like, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? You just try and break it down into manageable chunks. And when I say the education piece, you're just trying to get the kids to understand that you're going away for a short while. And, you know, you try and reinforce them that it's a job that has to be done. You're happy to do it. No different to anyone else. I mean, there's people get on a plane in Cork and are commuting over and back to London weekly. And also, I suppose every job brings its own challenges or its own kind of opportunities. So I suppose what you try and do then is when you're off, you try and maximise kind of family time with the kind of camping with the kids or I found that when you're off, you know, if you're 9 to 5 all the time, you kind of miss out on the weekday stuff. Whereas when the ship was alongside, you get time to do a lot more stuff where previously you didn't, if that makes sense. So do you know what? Pros and cons to everything. You know,
pros and cons, yeah. And we kind of mentioned briefly earlier as well about maybe some of the, particularly when there was the MV Matthew drug haul.
Yeah.
And that was across all our screens. It was front page of all the newspapers. We saw everyone in the Defence Forces suited and booted. And it looked, I can understand why school leavers would look at that and think, God, that's actually something I would love to do. I'd love to make a difference in that regard. That's one story we heard a lot about. There's probably countless others that never make it to the media.
Everyone on the ship would have a job to do. So, you know, when it comes to training, preparing and developing, the Naval Service would have a strict process there where there's always ongoing training and development. And there's a lot of trust placed in everyone on the ship. Like, it might be one thing getting the ship and making the decision to go on an operation such as the MV Matthew or the Machiavella, which would have happened a few years previous, or the Dances at Waves. The Naval Service have huge competence, knowledge and experience in that regard. But if the person driving the boat doesn't know what they're doing, or the person on the boarding team doesn't understand their role, you know, it's a failure across the ship. And that, you know, these operations have shown that that's not the case. I suppose the difference with the Matthew was it showed that the joint operations have a role to play in the Defence Forces moving forward. And it's time to embrace that and face the opportunities that come with that. Obviously, there's always challenges when you're bringing different elements of any organisation together, but it's only through constant training, which we would have done with the Army Rangers throughout my career when I was involved in different training evolutions or different operations. And then some of that, for good reason, has to go unannounced, because you don't want people knowing exactly what your capabilities are, because you have to be able to develop and learn and evolve in time, and you don't necessarily want to show everyone what you can do. I think there's an education piece around the whole interdiction operation. Ireland's had a success in this regard with the Naval Service. I'm sure some people would argue it's luck. I'd argue it's good intelligence. It's working with our partners across various agencies such as the Revenue, Customs, the wider Defence Forces planning, and more importantly, the Naval Service and MAOC-N, based in Lisbon. So there's a lot of work goes on behind the scenes to make these operations worthwhile. And just if I can give a small bit of context on that, a lot of other countries forward base naval vessels to try and interdict these operations closer to where the source of the manufacturing is. I don't know if it's common knowledge, but you know, to treat an addict or to help rehab an addict costs in a region of excessive 1.1, 1.2 million euros. So for every addict you have, that's kind of the cost you're looking at to try and help and support individuals kind of overcome their addiction. In addition to that, before they ever get to the element where they're going through recovery, there's the antisocial behavior, there's the issues socially within the community, there's the robberies, there's the thefts, there's people looking for money to feed habits. There is this misconception out there that drugs such as cocaine are for poor people or people living on the street. It's actually kind of middle class society is probably one of the biggest consumer of cocaine in Ireland. The point I'm making there is kind of Ireland is an island. During COVID, we never had so much cocaine on our streets, and bear in mind the airports are shut, which shows that we have huge vulnerabilities at sea. And it's important that we have proper maritime surveillance and a maritime presence to deter that. And yes, can you stop everything? No, of course you can't. But by enhancing the presence and trying to be more proactive and maybe basing ships and training people, like the Dutch and the UK would have had huge success in the Caribbean, Indian Ocean, Red Sea, Cape Verde, all those areas where kind of there are established drug routes coming across the Atlantic, etc. So they traditionally come across into the north, kind of northwest Africa, up through southern Europe, or else they bypass that and come up around the Irish coast, which is such as the interdictions you've seen. What we see there is only a fraction what's actually getting in, as evidenced by the national drug problem we have. But I suppose there's a big education piece there where I think if we explain to people that, like, people will say, like, oh, it costs money to do this. It does. It costs money to put a ship to sea that's going to sea anyway. But by locating the ship correctly, resourcing it with the correct intelligence and information, it can have more successful interdictions. It obviously won't get them all. There's no way it's impossible to interdict everything. But that would have a positive aspect on society, where if you could help interdict more, get more successful interdictions, you'd have a much, much better cost benefit analysis with your health service. And plus, you wouldn't have as many addicts, hopefully, kind of on the streets or in society.
So like a 157 million euro drug haul, that figure doesn't represent the benefit to society actually overall. That's actually really interesting. Another thing I want to touch on, Paul, is your current role. That was a bit of a departure from what you were doing. Tell me a little bit about what drew you to taking on this role.
I suppose, looking for a new challenge. The role for the head of college of the National Maritime College of Ireland came up. So as of kind of August last year, I'm the new head of college for the NMCI, or the National Maritime College of Ireland. Obviously, it's kind of related to what I've done. I've trained there. I would have worked there when I was in the naval service as well. So you kind of had a good understanding of it. There's a fantastic team there. That there's some great people that you get to meet. Some of them would have trained me. So maybe I'm the price they pay for their teaching skills and the impact they would have had on my career and my development. But it's a fantastic opportunity. Ireland is an island, and it's an island that's surrounded by water. And it would appear that kind of from a national development perspective, only since kind of the arrival of the offshore renewable energy, ORE, that people have realized there's a whole maritime space within which, I suppose, our maturity level at a national level is probably quite low compared to other countries who would be of an island nation kind of mindset. I think there's huge opportunities. Will there be challenges? Of course, but I more look at that as opportunities for where the college can progress kind of moving into the future, especially now as we come to our 20th anniversary.
Laying the foundations for potential that could be there is really important from a starting position if we're going to look at this. How can the college maybe mould and shape some of its graduates to prepare the industry for what it needs in terms of talent pool? Because that's always been something that we can differentiate ourselves with in Cork, is the deep and diverse talent pool we have.
I suppose my job for the next few years particularly is to reimagine that vision and prepare us for the future. So the college you'd see now is kind of built around the maritime industry that would have existed maybe say 25 years ago, when you factor in the design stage and getting the college ready. And then obviously the college would have opened in 2004. So a lot of our workshops and the equipment is kind of based on an industry that existed then. So we're very active at the minute developing a strategy for the college, the first in its history. So we'll have a 5-year strategy, hopefully by the middle of this year, which will look to position the college. So coming back to your question, bearing in mind where we are and where we need to get to with reimagining that vision, it's important to prepare us for delivering for the national ambition with the maritime economy. So a lot of the courses we actually deliver already for your basic maritime courses. Hopefully once all these wind farms, both fixed and floating, are developed off our coast, they must be maintained. So if you want to go and work in them, both in the initial construction stage and then in the operations and maintenance phase, you need those that training, because obviously you're going out into a harsh maritime environment. Our West Coast is some of the roughest seas in the world. So if something untoward were to happen or an incident, you know how to look after yourself and survive. There is an element there where we're developing courses, obviously to meet the current demand across the maritime industry, both for marine engineers, marine electrical engineers, and kind of deck cadets that ultimately go on to be ship's captains, chief engineers, etc. And obviously we have a demand then nationally, like all of the harbours you see have harbour masters running it. You'd have pilots for bringing vessels in and out. 20-25% of the pilots over in the London Port Authority are Irish. So again, we've a lot of Irish people who have gone on after completing the sea career to shore-based jobs. So for me, I call that onboarding to offboarding. So what we're looking to do, in addition to what we offer already, is to develop master level courses where people can develop courses such as Masters in Supply Chain Management, which we launched earlier this year, Masters in Port Operations, which is under development, so that we can help qualify people for going from a career at sea to a career ashore. So that's kind of a key focus at the college moving forward.
Port infrastructure is something that will be critical in developing our offshore renewable industry. How important is the port infrastructure in getting it to where it needs to be?
I suppose the easiest way I can sum it up is Ireland probably has a 19th century port infrastructure, and where ports have looked to develop, but by and large they've more or less remained the same. So we kind of have an expectation on the ports that they're going to be ready to sustain a 21st and hopefully a 22nd century country. There's a balance needs to be struck there, where we've commercial ports that will need areas of space to develop the ORE, and like Port of Cork is planning already, being from Cork and having a college in Cork. I do think Cork Harbour is the ultimate kind of ideal location to set up a hub for supporting the offshore renewable energy industry, because we've got Varome Dockyard, which would have had a history of shipbuilding, now is getting ready to develop ORE. We've Port of Cork with planning permission to develop space for ORE. We've the National Maritime College of Ireland, something no other area has. We also have the second largest natural harbour in the world, which does have a lot of space and is ideal for supporting certain elements of ORE. I don't think it can meet everything moving into the future, but certainly a lot of the requirements for the operations and maintenance and the initial fixed bottom turbine construction and the support required there, I think it has that capability. When the farm industry came to Ireland, particularly Cork, a lot of people didn't know it. We would have had a workforce at the time that was about 20% third level qualified. I'm not saying third level is the solution to everything. Like, we do have things like apprenticeships coming online, and like even a career at sea, I'd argue, is vocational as opposed to necessarily a third level qualification. Whereas 30 years later with the pharma, we've an educated workforce in around 70-75%. We've had a massive community benefit of what the farm industry brought to Cork. It'll be the same for ORE. You'll have community funds. With the timeline for ORE, you're looking at 10 to 15 years as it kind of works its way from the East Coast to the South Coast to the West Coast. It's actually primary schools, I think, we need to be spending some time at and getting out and educating people as to what ORE is, the opportunities it will bring. And that's certainly a focus we'll have in the Maritime College. Most of us are kind of our age bracket now, when people kind of leaving school, will probably be the foundation level. They'll start to be kind of the early converters, early focus, I suppose, people who'll move into that space kind of in the early stages. It's the sustainment pieces is what'll actually be important. There may be a reliance to bring people in for external. The BVG report recently kind of highlights some of that if Ireland doesn't kind of get certain elements in place or start the ball rolling in certain key areas such as maritime education and training, we will be reliant on international workers to come and support that. But again, I think getting into primary schools, and I think the chambers have a big role here, educating people, letting people know, back to the point I was making about the drug interdiction operation, it's just making people aware of what goes on and how these things actually work in reality. Something I don't think we're very good at in Ireland is the maritime education and training piece, and actually getting out to schools and showing people what a career at sea looks like. I've been at plenty of career days now where people think you have to spend 40 years at sea, never see your family and look like Popeye. That's not the case. Ships nowadays have modern training facilities. They have saunas, they've got Wi-Fi. Contracts are like a month on and month off, depending on the type of life you want to live or the kind of industry you want to be involved in. So again, it's getting people to realise that. I mean, as a country, 50% of our population live within 5 kilometres of the coastline. Imagine that as your commute to work. So when you factor in the cities like Cork, Dublin, in particular Cork, there's a lot of people who'd have immediate access to working. And again, back to the harbour and why it should be a hub for ORE. And I suppose not only of all the things I've mentioned already, but most importantly is access to the national grid. So the energy that's produced offshore can actually come straight via subsurface cables in land in Cork and get onto the national grid and meet the national demand.
Cork, we have such a strong seafaring background. We should have more dependency on the sea, really, for our livelihoods, and we don't anymore. So how important is it, given the potential opportunity of offshore and what people are saying about being the next Pharma, is government backing, government support here for this very crucial part of the education sector?
The BVG report is very useful. It gives a very good snapshot of what's going on, and it gives different scenarios based on kind of business as usual or government intervention. It's not just funding in infrastructure. Like, you have to do the education piece and the communication piece and tell people what good looks like. And other countries have had huge success in this regard, like developing supply chain management routes. Countries that get that right have a very good track record with ORE. I suppose it's important to start generating the momentum and the narrative around that and to get people interested in developing careers at sea. Some interesting research I would have read a number of years ago. Dublin has a population of maybe about 1.5 million, doesn't consider itself a coastal county. Without Dublin, think of the trade that goes on between Dublin and the UK, that sea bridge. So there's quite a huge presence, obviously, in Dublin Port itself. But again, it's interesting that in excess of a million people don't view themselves as a coastal county. We tend to be a very inward-looking country in that, you know, we've had a huge success with our agriculture industry and long may that continue. But we've set up Chagas, who's been highly successful in the educational piece. For the sea fisheries, BIM have been highly successful in, you know, reaching out to communities and working with communities to raise the profile of careers in the seafood industry. It needs to be the same with maritime, and the NMCI is more than ready to step up and deliver that. So I do think there's an awareness piece to understand that we have to raise that profile, but also there will be a funding requirement to make sure that it's done right.
Where would you like to see yourself going with this role over the next 10 to 15 years?
First priority is to get our 5-year strategy up and running. That helps give us direction and helps us to reimagine the vision the government of the day had 20 years ago when they created the NMCI. I mean, their vision was that there'd be a national maritime college that could deliver Ireland's maritime education and training. We've probably done that for the last 20 years through a fantastic team. By having that strategy, I think it gives us a good springboard to get our funding requirement correct, our funding model, and also allows us to support the national ambition within the maritime economy. Looking out 10, 15 years, firstly, I'd like to think that we'd have modernised the college. So in 15 years, we're coming back to government looking for more investment to see through the succession of investment they've had to date. Like any third level college, there's always a need for modernising, keeping us up with the prerequisite levels, you know, of technology, of facilities, of infrastructure to support where the government's going. I think one challenge that is kind of, it's affecting everyone in society, but the same at third level, is accommodation. It would be great to see some sort of accommodation solution looked at for the NMCI, because I think if you actually got that right, most of the training required for the national ambition in the maritime, if in 10 years we had a modern NMCI, we had an accommodation solution, an accommodation block, and we were starting to have a good result with a positive strategic communications plan, I think we'd be in a pretty good position for setting the country up for its ambitions in the maritime economy looking out to 2040, 2050.